The slippers of the mortal earth now touch the chest of the moon. Oh, it is shameful that the misery of hunger is still continuing as it was in the past. Manmohan Acharya. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate your support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will peruse our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, as always, I would like to thank you as well. Today, I planned on finishing up kind of talking about some stuff I touched on last week, and I kind of wanted to tie some things in together I talked about last week and the week before. And then, depending on the time, we may start to move kind of north and east to talk about peoples living along the Ganges or the and the Brahmaputra portion of the Indo-Gangetic Plain between 6 and 4,000 BC, but that's going to depend on time for kind of the stuff I wanted to finish up on. Before that, though, I did want to thank one of our listeners, Arjun. He had recommended a book to me in English, and I was able to find it actually fairly easily. It wasn't online. I couldn't get an audiobook, which that's how I do a lot of my reading these days. I listen to audiobooks to and from work and when I'm traveling, but I did find a very nice collector's edition of a book, and it's not written by a single person, but it's a it's part of a series, but it's tales of heroes, gods, and monsters, and there's one specifically for India and their myths and legends. It's got an introduction by Dr. Raj Balkaran, and it's edited by J.K. Jackson. It's a very interesting book. I've already gotten, I think, about a quarter of the way through, and I got it Friday. So I've actually been tearing into it this weekend. But it's a nice frame of reference, and it's got a great glossary section, and that includes glossaries for, I think, other parts that they cover. So it's got Greek stuff, Roman stuff, and parts like other parts of the world. So there's some, it's a very excellent reference book. And it's got details about the Indian myths that I am not familiar with. I'm still plugging through parts of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana as I go. And there are other Hindu texts I'm trying to find decent translations. The problem is a lot of them are fairly expensive to get really well done ones in English. At least that's what I'm finding online, so I've kind of been trying to find open sources of those when I can. But again, thank you, Arjun, for your recommendation. It's been very helpful. But with all that out of the way, let's go ahead and get started. So last week, one of the things that I talked about was the Dravidian language family and how most linguists place the proto-form of this language as emerging at some point during this season, 6,000 to 4,000 BC. And I gave a rough overview of how the modern branches of the family are spread. But I do want to make sure I am clear. There are plenty of areas where Indo-European languages and Dravidian languages are spoken in very close proximity to each other. And when you look at maps of those type of things, they'll generally only show the family or branch of said family that the majority people living in that area use as their primary language. So I do want to just mention areas where, what I talked about last week, those are the areas where the modern Dravidian languages are spoken as the primary language. They're not the only languages spoken there, but they make up the majority of speakers. And that will go true, you know, the case is that Indo-European languages, when they begin to definitively show up in India. There's a debate about that, but that's all stuff we'll cover later. Now, I say all this so I can talk about languages that are not part of these macro families, because there are quite a number in the Indian subcontinent today, though I will only be talking about a few of these, as there are several that can be traced to population movements that are happening at later periods, like the Indo-European languages. I also wanted to make clear that I am not arguing that speakers of any of these languages, or that you speak any of these languages, means that their speakers have any greater claim to the land or that they're more Indian than anyone else. That's not what I'm saying. If you could trace these peoples or peoples who speak Dravidian languages, if you could trace their lineages back through time to the period that we're talking about, they probably share some of the same ancestors. It's just a question of which ones and in, you know, what order. So languages, like people, travel, and they do so in different ways than people. And the reasons that one language travels further and spreads farther are as varied as the reasons that various peoples travel further and farther. And we'll talk about all those sorts of things several times in the course of this show. So I'm sure we've lost countless tongues to this journey through time, but you know, before we've had means to record them. But some have survived in small number, and this is evidence of a people or culture that existed, however small or large, and I feel like they deserve some mention because they were involved in the history of the region, and indeed the history of humanity as a whole. Though, again, as we will see, some of these are very hard to place. So they probably existed in some form, though whether or not they exist in this region during this season's time period, which again, 6,000 to 4,000 BC, that's more debatable. But I do want to mention that it's a possibility. It also gives me something to kind of pad out some of these episodes. Now, let's go back to a part of the subcontinent we talked about last week. Specifically, it's in the modern state of Maharashtra. And this is kind of on the eastern side, or excuse me, the western side of India. And it's kind of where you start to leave the plain, and as you go south, you begin to head up into the Deccan Plateau. At least that's where this part of the region kind of starts. But specifically, it's along a very narrow portion of the Tapti River. Now, this river's name comes from a regional pronunciation of the Hindu goddess Tapati. She is a daughter of the Hindu sun god Surya and his wife Svarta. So in addition to being the goddess of the river is a personification of her, she's also a goddess of warmth. You know, that would make sense, being that she's related to the sun. But she's also kind of a mother slash fertility goddess in this part of the south, and in other parts too. But along that river, there are a string of villages where around 2,000 to 3,000 people speak a language known as Nihali. Now, as you might have guessed from the number of speakers, this is a very endangered language. Today, no one who speaks this language is monolingual. They may have learned Nihali as their birth tongue, but as time goes on and they grow up, they do learn one of the languages of their various neighbors. Now, the name comes from the word Nihal, which means tiger. Now, this is where we kind of get into some confusion. There is another language very close by that is also referred to as Nihali, and that language is considered an Indo-European language. Now, this is actually referred to as the Kalto language. They have around 15 to 20,000 speakers. Now, Kalto is an endonym, which means the people who speak that language refer to themselves as Kalto. Nihali can be used in a derogatory manner and has been used as a derogatory term. Though, again, it means tiger. In and of itself, it's not bad, but it's all in the context that it's used. And the Kalto speakers and the Nihali speakers live very similar lifestyles, or at least they have traditionally lived similar lifestyles. They're focused more on hunter-gatherers. They live in smaller communities, and they are fishermen living along the river. You know, it makes sense that they would be inclined to fish. But they do practice some agriculture, but up until recently, it was not their primary mode of life. So, because of all this stuff, they're often confused with each other. Now, there is a little bit of controversy that arises because of this. So the Kalto contend that the Nahali are an offshoot of their people and culture, and that they broke away during a period of internal strife among their people. That being said, I don't think many outside groups believe that or recognize those claims or even really care about those claims. Regardless, Nihali has not been categorized by any linguist as belonging to any other family, at least not to an extent that it has been proven to a majority of linguists. There are theories, but no one theory has won out a majority of like the scholarship on the subject. So it might belong to, you know, one of their neighboring families, but no one has proven anything. And, you know, we'll get into that. The primary reason for that is that there are a number of what you would think are very important base words. You know, things for simple things, something that most people have or deal with that are not used in any other language that they neighbor. This includes things like head or blood. A head in Nihali is Kuguso, and blood is Korto. Then you also have water, which is Japo. And then you have a food that's fairly common, egg. For them, it is Kalan. So these are all, you know, fairly straightforward words that, you know, they're the basis. They're very basic words. And these are things that no one else shares around them. That being said, Nahali has a very large amount of loan words or words that were derived from words from other language families. In fact, 60 to 70% of their dictionary, I guess, are from their neighboring languages. And that includes not just Dravidian or Indo-European, but also Austroasiatic. There's a branch of Austroasiatic in India that we'll talk about later, but this language probably entered into the subcontinent at some point around 2000 BC in the northeast, and then they spread kind of to the west, southwest, kind of towards the central part of the continent, meaning that the speakers of the Proto-Nihali language were probably further east at some point. So it's very hard to classify or even really know if Proto-Nihali existed at this point as a separate tongue. And if it did, where it was spoken initially. Regardless, if it was spoken during this time period, during this season, it was a very different tongue for what you would expect. And it's being spoken by people who are probably still in that hunter-gatherer lifestyle. They don't need words for various types of grown grains. They just refer to them more in general terms. At least that's the way it works with other proto-languages. At least that's, you know, what the scholarship says. And we know that various hunter-gatherer groups persisted well past even when the Neolithic, quote-unquote, arrives in India, and even as it moves east along the Indo-Gangetic Plain, and even as it moves south, there are still plenty of groups that still live, you know, a more hunter-gatherer, fisher-focused lifestyle. And it's possible that and there are theories, I should say, that people speaking a kind of Nihali or the Asiatic, the Austroasiatic languages that influenced Nihali are mentioned in both the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Peoples referred to in those works are sometimes called the Nishadas. In those works, these people are associated with hunting in the hills and forests to the south, and also being fishers and boatmen who facilitate travel in the wilder, more untamed rivers to the south. And they're also associated with facilitating travel through those regions, if you get their permission. If you don't get their permission, or you get too close to the lands, they are very fierce defenders and protectors of those lands. Also, in some stories, they are more akin to bandits. They prey on their more settled neighbors. That's not to say that, you know, they considered them bad. It's just that they had a very wide range of roles in these different stories. Some people were very highly praised. Some people were more shunned. But these were individuals who belonged to the Nishadas. There wasn't a overarching archetype of these people in those stories. Now, and again, a lifestyle associated with the Nahali is that they were, you know, associated with fishing and riding boats along the river. That is when they're not associated with doing various agricultural labor for their neighbors. That does happen into the modern period. They will kind of rent their services out as laborers. Sometimes they're forced into it. Sometimes it's a mutually beneficial relationship, though not quite as beneficial to the Nahali, as we will talk about in the future. Though I should point out that the theory that the, you know, the Austroasiatic or the Nahali speakers, that is a very, you know, niche theory. There is also the theory that I think is more popular is that the term Nishada was just a general term that referred to anyone not belonging to the social classes or the Varnas mentioned in the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, that they're kind of a people that are separate, that live to the fringes of the, societies that composed and retold those works. So just keep that in mind as well. Now, the second language isolate I want to discuss is, it's back further where we went a few episodes ago. And today it's found spread between three valleys in the Gilgit-Baltistan region, which is a smaller part of the wider Kashmir region that is currently disputed between India and Pakistan. And this is the isolate known as Burushashki. And I'm sure I butchered that. But it has around 150,000 known speakers today, or primary speakers. And it is considered, again, a language isolate. There are several theories on which languages this may be connected to. There are people who try to connect it to groups coming in from the from the West. There have been some attempts to link them with maybe some languages coming down from Siberia. There are those that think it is like a part of like a early form of Proto-Indo-Hittite or Phrygian. I don't think anyone really subscribes to most of these now. I think the one, there are some people who think it might be connected to the North Caucasian languages, though most of these ones are kind of, you know, been discredited, or not necessarily discredited, but some of them have been discredited. They're just not accepted at all, but they're still, you know, they were at one point considered possibilities, though. Again, a lot of those have just been completely disregarded. But then there are also those that believe that this was a language spoken up in the hills. It may have originated in somewhere along the Tibetan Plateau, and these people moved down where they met Proto-Dravidian speakers, or perhaps people coming in from the Zagros. And there is, you know, plenty of overlap in some words between Dravidian and Proto-Indo-European words, especially when it comes to things like agriculture. So they definitely adopted some words from those languages. But I think the right now, at least the predominant theory, is that this was kind of a language family that had been isolated from where it initially came from, or it developed in the region, and then it began to be influenced by their neighbors who were, you know, bringing in these new technologies or developing these new technologies, So I think right now, the general consensus is, hey, these people were here, or they were further north, and they came down through the valleys of the Tibetan Plateau, and they entered into the region where they learned, you know, about agriculture and all this stuff from the people who had been developing it there. So that's the current consensus. Now, today there are, it's spoken in three valleys, the Yasin, the Hunza Valley, and the Nagar Valley. Now, Hunza and Nagar are very close to each other. They're technically, I guess, part of the same larger valley, and they're just kind of offshoots of that. But the Yasin Valley is kind of on its own. And there's a kind of a gap in the land or in the regions where they're not connected anymore. And I think, again, the current consensus seems to believe that the Yasin Valley is more isolated, and that the people speaking the dialect of the Burushaski language there have a less influenced, or, and I hate to use this word, because it has a lot of ethnic connotations, but a pure or original strain of Burushaski in it. Though, again, don't think of it in ethnic terms or, you know, anything like that. So that is that language. Again, it's fairly it's fairly widely spoken. It's the most spoken of the dialects I'm going to be talking about tonight. It is considered endangered, technically, but it is vulnerable. It is not nearly as bad off as Nihali. Now, Burushaski is not listed, at least as far as I'm aware. I haven't seen any mention of it, and I haven't seen anything like it in the little bit of reading of the Mahabharata or anything like that I've read. But it's not really listed in any Hindu or Indian sources anywhere. It is potentially mentioned, though, in Tibetan sources. There are some Tibetan sources that mention a Bruja language in the Gilgit Valley. So there are people who think that that is an early reference to that language. And they have used a script that was very similar to a script that was used to write an extinct language, Zhangzhung, which is a Sino-Tibetan language. It was spoken in Western Tibet, so they may have shared an alphabet. I look forward into researching that a little bit more. But that's obviously something that's not happening this season, so I haven't really touched on it too much. Now, the last group I'm going to be discussing for this kind of section is the Veda, or the Wanyalaleto. And I'm sure I butchered that, but I believe I mentioned them last season. But they're a minority group on the island of Sri Lanka. And they are broken into a couple of different communities. There are some that live along the coast, and some that live up kind of in the central mountains of Sri Lanka. But their name can sometimes be called the Veda, the Vada, the Veda, the Veta, or the Vado, depending on, you know, the language used to describe them. Now, that term either comes from the Tamil word Vedan, which means hunter, or the Sanskrit Vadya, which means hunter, or Vidar, which literally means the one who pierces. It's kind of up in the air who gave them that name. And as you would guess from the name, they're primarily hunter-gatherers, at least they were. Their population is extremely low. I think they have around no more than 6,000 at this point in time. At least those still living their traditional lifestyle. I think a significant portion of their population has assimilated at this point or died out. Now, there has been a little bit of development since last season, though. They did do a mitochondrial and autosomal DNA study of a lot of India in the last couple of years. And they just released the, I guess, the results for the Veda people. And I say just. It was back in 2004. I think it was in... hold on, let me check my date. This was the Genetic Identity of the Veda, a Language Isolate of Southeast Asia. This was published in... Hold on. Checking. Double-checking my dates here. I didn't write this down. This was published in... does it have a date? It should have a date. Ah, May of 2024. So I do think this was after that episode. But regardless, I hadn't read it, I don't think, when I had done that episode. And it shows that mitochondrial DNA-wise, they were more closely related to the Santhal, the Zhuang, Irala, and the Paniya tribes of mainland India, as opposed to the Sinhalese and Sri Lankan Tamils. Now, that is not to say that they're not related to the Sinhalese or Sri Lankan. There has been intermarriage between those groups, but it looks like they're more closely related to those other groups. And, interestingly enough, the Santhal and the Zhuang, I believe, all speak an Austroasiatic tongue. And I'm not sure about... Hold on, let me double check this. Okay, yes. The Irula and the Paniya, they speak Dravidian languages, which Tamil is a Dravidian language. So, but today, the Veda speak the Veda language. It is not a Dravidian language. It is not Austroasiatic. It is technically considered a Creole language. I think it is most closely associated with Sinhalese, or at least they have a lot of Sinhalese terms, which Sinhalese, I think, is Indo-European, technically, or it's branched off Indo-European. But it's primarily Sinhalese, along with a mix of, you know, several other languages that the Veda have absorbed over time as other groups have migrated in. The Veda have always kind of been on the... kind of the outskirts of the various peoples who've migrated to the island. Sometimes they, you know, they coexisted rather peacefully. Sometimes, you know, they were kind of pushed back or assimilated at various rates into those societies. But there's always been a portion of them that have always retained their hunter-gatherer classical lifestyle. So they're, you know, they're part of this kind of group of some people who have not assimilated one of these larger language families. Though, again, that is probably going to change. Within the next probably 50 years, this language will probably be completely gone. If not the Veda themselves, the language will probably have been forgotten. I should point out that the version of Sinhalese that they have adapted is actually a very archaic form of Sinhalese. It's a much older one, from like the 12th century, I think, AD. So very, very old. They haven't really kept up with some of the changes that the Sinhalese language has gone under over time. So just keep that in mind as well. Let's see. What are we at time? We're almost at half an hour. Yeah, I think I'll go ahead and call this episode here. Now, there, again, are other language isolates in India that we'll be talking about as we go forward. But I wanted to kind of go ahead and cover these because I'm leaving these regions behind this season. I didn't want to forget the possibility that these are distinct groups during this period, or, you know, I didn't want to not mention that there were peoples who were not speaking a Dravidian tongue or something along those lines. There's probably several language families that have just been lost or absorbed as time has gone on. So just wanted to kind of put that out there and make sure I was kind of covering as much as I could. Next week, we will finally get into the Ganges part of the Indo-Gangetic Plain. We'll also be talking about the Brahmaputra, which is the river that cuts through most of modern-day Bangladesh. So that'll be the focus for the next couple of episodes. Probably then we'll cover kind of the border regions between northern India and the Tibetan Plateau. And then we'll move into Southeast Asia. So we are making progress here. We are advancing along. I would like to thank everyone who's listened this week. And again, thank you, Arjun, for recommending that book. It's very helpful, and I'm looking forward to using that as a source going forward when we talk about Hindu myths and religion and things like that. But yeah, thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you have enjoyed the episode. Please feel free to reach out, provide any questions, comments, constructive criticism, sources, anything like that you'd like to bring to my attention. I would be more than glad to listen at and look at and read. You can contact me via direct message on X or Twitter. You can send me an email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can comment on the YouTube videos, all that kind of good stuff. So, and please, wherever you're listening to, like, subscribe, download, rate 5 stars, whatever you have available on that platform, I would really appreciate. I've heard a couple of people say that the Spotify episodes aren't displaying correctly, but I haven't had any issues pulling them up on Spotify. So if you guys have noticed something similar, please let me know. I would very much like to see if there's an issue, but according to RSS, it's updating there. So, I would very much like any additional confirmation. So. But thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you listen to this. And I hope to see everyone next time. Hope you all have a good one. Peace.